Welcome to the Board Game Workshop. I'm your host, Chris Anderson, and we are back from a bit of a hiatus, although I did say that this was going to be an irregular schedule, so missing January is part of that. So we are here with...
I am Carla Kopp from Weird Giraffe Games and Galactic Raptor Games, two companies, and sometimes I forget the other one, but that's okay. My contact info is on Twitter. I'm at Weird Giraffes, and that's multiple giraffes. My email is contact@weirddraftgames.com, and I also have a Facebook page.
And you've been on the show numerous times, so if people want to listen to other stuff by you, they can go to the website and look up your name.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Kevin Russ, a board game designer. My Twitter is Kevin T. Russ, and on Instagram, it is Gorge River Game Studio.
And Dustin.
So this is Dustin Dowdle, and I'm with Odd Fox Games. You can find me on Facebook with that same name, and I'm also on the Board Game Workshop's Discord channel.
And people should join the Discord. We got to get that going, especially for the contest. It's going to be lots of questions to answer. So we are here to talk about Tumbletown, designed by Kevin, published by Carla. So how would you like to start discussing Tumbletown?
Maybe Kevin can give the, overview, or I can.
Sure, I can give an overview. Tumbletown is a dice game, engine and town building. But it's a, so there's some dice stacking, and you are building buildings out of dice that have color and value requirements, and... trying to make the best town possible.
Cool. So I remember seeing this a very long time ago, probably on Twitter, and I think it was right when you decided to pick it up, Carla, or maybe even before that when you were just thinking of doing it and had that interesting building with dice mechanism. So let's kind of do an overview of the story. So how did this begin? Was it designed and then you saw it, Carla, or where did it start?
So Kevin had designed the game, and I met Kevin at Origins. I feel like that was 2 years ago.
2018, yeah.
Well, mostly because I was at Origins, and I thought that I could just run a booth for 8 hours and be fine, and that was actually not the case. I need to use the restroom at some point during the day. So I put out a Twitter thing, a help signal, and Kevin arrived. And it was fantastic, so I got to meet Kevin. And the next con we went to was Gen Con, and we were playing games after the regular business hours. And one of the games ended up being Tumbletown, and I loved it because, there's not that many Western games, but I really liked the whole stacking of the dice. From then, I think it was maybe a month after that I signed the game, and we've been working on it since.
So it goes to show that just helping people out at a convention can be the answer to getting your game published.
Oh yeah, definitely. Whenever people help out, then we become friends, and then we hang out at all the cons. I see Kevin once a month.
I wish I could go to that many cons. I'm actually probably going to miss my local con next week because I forgot to buy a ticket early enough.
Well, cons are nice, but going to as many as I do, it sometimes you feel like you're dead inside.
Well, it's work for you. I'd just go for fun.
Yeah.
I don't have to ever run a booth.
You could, though.
I could. That's. I don't know. No. Maybe. I talked about being a publisher. It's still on my plate somewhere. We'll see.
Kevin, did you go through the pitching process or... How did just the beginnings of that work out?
There was no pitching process. Actually, Carla was the first publisher to see the game. I came up with the idea over that summer, kind of between Origins and Gen Con. And then, Gen Con is when she saw it.
So right time, right place, and you just snatched it up, huh?
Yeah, have you pitched a game before, or was this your first foray into doing things?
No, this was the beginning of everything for me, really. I hadn't pitched a game. I hadn't really designed a game that I wanted to show anyone before. I mean, I had some ideas, but this was the first one that felt like it could be something. So, just got lucky, I guess.
Nah, it's always this easy.
So, like, from my perspective, I think over half the games I've signed haven't been pitched to me. They've just been people playing games, and then I like them.
I always remember the story of you trying to get Fire in the Library from Tony.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, you didn't know that I was trying to sign it, and there was, like, a couple months between the whole, like, actually, like, me wanting to sign it and me convincing him that I actually wanted to sign it.
But it's a great story now.
Oh, that is a great story.
So you played it at Gen Con, and did you decide right there that you wanted to sign it, or was it, let me take this home and look at it some more, or how'd it go from there?
So I have a rule where I don't sign anything at cons because, well, as you said, like, I run a booth, and I talk to a lot of people, so, like, when I'm at a con, I'm not in the best mental state. So I'm always like, okay, I really love this game while I'm at the con, but then, like, I give myself, like, a week or two to actually, like, think about it and be like, did I really like that game, or did I just really like playing a game and not, like, a lot of human interaction?
So did you take a copy home from there, or...?
No, I just thought about it. Like, I took pictures and stuff.
I think I might have sent print and play, or at least something that you could see a little closer, Carla, if I remember right.
Yeah, that sounds right.
So then you took it home, you looked at it, and you decided you do want to sign it. What goes into that process? So like you said, like, at a con, you're not necessarily thinking straight, so you don't want to make a decision there. So what goes into that decision once you have the time to look something over?
So one part of it is the game, and the other part of it is the person. I have learned that I really need to get the right person to work with, mostly because I am a very particular kind of person. Not everyone enjoys working with me, and that's just a fact of life, and I'm fine with it. But when I, like, sign a game, I want to actually collaborate and go back and forth. So this, like, whatever game it is, the designer has to be, like, really great at, you know, human interaction, being able to tell me things, like, just being able to talk and, like, get feedback and give feedback as well. So that's part of it. And since Kevin had helped out at the booth, like, I got to, like, meet him and know him, so... I kind of knew, like, at that point that he was probably a person that I could work with. And then it goes into the game. With the game, I really like something that's a little bit different or weird. I mean, I'm weird draft games, so I can't have, like, regular normal games. They're usually games that are, like, common mechanics, but, like, just something a little different and off. So, like, I have to think about the game and see if it can, like, fit into that whole, like, is it a weird draft game? Because there's plenty of games out there that are really good, but they don't fit in my product line.
So what was that part of the process like for you, Kevin? Did you just sit and wait, or was there communication?
No, I was pretty much, I just sat and waited. I think they may have played it once with a design group, and they were asking for some clarifications on some stuff. I mean, this also could have been after it was signed. It's hard to remember back then, but there wasn't a whole lot of communication. I just remember getting an email at some point. I was in around Denver at the time that they wanted to sign it.
Yeah, I know the tense waiting process when someone has your game, like for a contest or a pitch. And you're checking all their social media, you're seeing if they show a picture or they say anything, but you don't want to harass them. You just want to know if they've done anything with it.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, though, is, like, if anyone, like, sends me, like, a game that I'm thinking of, I don't post on social media about it. Like, that's one of, like, I don't know if it's, like, taboo, but, like, you don't want to pass on a game and have people know that you passed, because it might be a great game and just not the right fit, or not, like, there could be, like, some, like, tiny thing that's wrong with it or whatever. Like, so, like, I'll never post about a game until, like, I'm pretty sure, like, it's going to be signed. I might say that, like, oh, yeah, I played this game at this convention, but I won't, like, post about any game that I'm, like, thinking about. If that makes sense.
I gotta look for the tiny details. Like, if you say you're playtesting tonight, maybe that's my game. Who knows? Dustin, do you have a question?
No, that's funny. I'm curious, once the game was picked up, how much did the game evolve and change through that development process?
So, we recently did a number of videos for the Kickstarter, and one of them was on the different development processes. And at first I was like, oh yeah, we had like three versions of Tumbletown, and we both kind of agreed on that. But then when we actually like sat down and were like, okay, what was the development process like? There was 8 distinct versions of the game, but we also worked on it for almost 2 years. So I feel like that's not too many.
I mean, it seems reasonable to me. I've been working on a game for, I think it's 3 years now, and I'm starting up version 25, so.
Oh, yeah.
Just how it goes.
Yeah, like sometimes, well, like the main core of the game is still there. Like, we still have the dice stacking, and I think the beginning still had, like, dice manipulation. So, like, the core is there. It's just there was a number of tweaks to get, like, the end game right. Like, the end game is sometimes really hard on games. To find the right end game and the right like balance of all the things, because well, again, going back to games as a product, like there are things that I like as like a game player that I really was sad like about getting rid of in Tumbletown. For instance, we used to have the backs of the cards. Each one was unique, and depending on what like type of card you took, you would get also the back of the card. But that was more gamery than I really wanted for like a weird draft game. So making it into a product was sometimes like a hard decision, but probably the right one.
So Kevin, what was that process like for you as things got cut away from your absolutely perfect design that you created?
The way I look at it, as long as the game is getting better, I'm fine with doing whatever, you know. And it was still in fairly early stages when Carla signed it, so you know it's bound to go through a lot of changes still at that point.
So you said 8 versions. Can you go over just what were the changes between each version? And this is a problem I run into with my own designs. When do you call it a distinct version? Because I'll have a lot of 2.1, 2.2, 2.3, 2.4. I'm like, okay, maybe it's 3.1, maybe it's not. And I sort of jump around on numbers.
So with the distinct versions, we didn't actually call them distinct versions until afterwards when we were like, oh, how many versions were there? So it's just, as a process, it was like a continuous thing. But what the different versions were, well, first, it was just like the base version that Kevin pitched. The second version were these dice mines. And what the dice mines did is that there was just dice in like a little mine shape. Typically, when you got dice, you would roll them. But this was a bit like random because it's dice. So we thought, okay, to make it less random, you get some dice that you roll, and you get some dice that you know the values out of the dice mine. So that was version 2, which it solved the problem, but the issue with that is that when you're getting dice, some of the dice you rolled and some of the dice you didn't roll, and during playtesting, like, it was so hard to get people to do the right thing. Like, they thought that they didn't have to roll any of them, or they rolled the ones from the dice mine. And whenever anything is, like, too hard to get people to actually do correctly, after, like, a number of times telling them, like, I just have to axe it. Like, get rid of the dice mines. Like, the dice mines were cool, but people not being able to do it right meant it had to go away. So instead, Kevin...
can't fight your players.
Yeah, I mean, you can't. Like, if something is too hard, just get rid of it. Like I remember so many times of just trying to, like, have it in, like, reference cards or other things, and it just, you know what? This is hard and stressful, so let's not. So we took out the dice mines, and Kevin added more mitigation to the cards. So the third one, got rid of the dice mines, add more mitigation. The fourth version, we had every player start off with a shack, where they just build their first building, and it was this really easy shack to build, and it all the shacks were different, but this was hard because, you know, like, we had something like 20 or so different shacks, and then I was, like, trying to separate them into the easy ones and the hard ones because, like, some players just couldn't understand what the shack did if they got, like, a difficult one. So to fix that problem, instead of the shacks, we gave everyone a horse. And what the horse did was it could add one or subtract one from your dice, and that's super simple. There was no confusion on what the horse did, so it was great. The fifth version, we added in this set collection thing. So adding on the horse, like, well, the horse front was the same for everyone, but the horse back, the back of the card, not the butt of the horse, was the set collection. I mean, people have said we should make the card a horse butt, but I don't want to, like, ask an artist to draw a horse butt or pay for an artist to draw a horse butt. So that was my own personal thing against horse butts. But on the back of this card, there was a set collection mechanic where we had four different colored icons on all the different buildings, and the back of the horse would give you 1 point for a certain color of icon. So this was really good for the game because it gave players more direction. Like, before, they just, you know, go forth, build buildings, and there wasn't really, like, a... Like, for people that are bad at making choices, they were like, oh no, there's so many buildings, I could build any of them, which do I build? But with this, they would start, and they would only look at, like, 1/4 of the buildings, and it got down the whole AP thing a lot by having the set collection. So the sixth version. This is, like, one of my favorite changes to the game, because I think it made it really different, there's one type of card in the game. There's gold buildings, there's level 2 buildings that are either black or gray, and there's level 1 brown buildings. For the gold buildings, Kevin added in this really cool thing where it started giving you, the gold buildings give you, like, additional scoring conditions, and he added those scoring conditions to have, to be things that you could have on your other cards, like for having a certain type of cacti on the constructed buildings you have, or birds, or the stovepipes, or like certain windows, like just random things like that, where you could start getting points like, oh, you made a 3 wide building? Well, I score extra points for that, so I'm going to start getting more 3 wide buildings, or with the agave plant, or whatever it was. Which I thought was really cool because normally people wouldn't look at the art. Like, the art is just art. It's just there. But this gave you a reason to, like, really pay attention to the art, which I thought was cool. The seventh version of the game, Kevin made this really cool spatial puzzle aspect to it, where before you were just putting your little buildings in front of the card after you built it, and there were just a line of them. But with the Main Street aspect added, you would put your buildings on your Main Street card, and you can get extra points if you, like, match up the criteria to the building. So that added on, like, an extra layer for people. Like, if you like spatial aspects, it's like trying to get the engine building aspects of the cards that you want, but also the right buildings so you match your Main Street. And then finally, the last version of the game, it was to strip out the whole, like, the backs of the cards are all different. And that was because, so when players are choosing what building they want, they take the building card, and so the next card would come out. And that card back would be different. So the next player in line would then be like, oh, well, I'd wanted to get this card, but if I go into that same row that the last player just went into, I could get these things, and then they would have to like rethink their whole turn, and that's not what I like. Like, I like short and quick turns that you don't have to like reevaluate after every player's turn. So getting rid of the powers, it made things like simpler, which was a sad part, but it got the game time down a lot, especially for people that are bad at choosing things. And that's like the current aspect, or the current version of Tumbletown.
So please tell me you were going off of notes, because if that was all done by memory, that's amazing.
Oh yes, so I definitely had notes. When we were talking earlier and you asked me like what topic we should have, I was like, oh gosh, did I take notes on this? Because if I didn't, I can't remember this all. But yes, I had a numbered list. It was excellent. Great.
Well, it sounds like so many of the game decisions were based on improving the game. Were any decisions based on manufacturing the game and cost and those kinds of things? What was that considered?
I made certain other decisions with manufacturing. For instance, the game has 100 dice. And everyone, like, that ever, like, playtested this game, like, designers would be like, you know, there's 100 dice in this game. How are you manufacturing that? And I was like, yes, I do realize that there's 100 dice in this. Like, I get it. I know numbers. I've been carrying around these dice. And people just wouldn't, like, believe that I acknowledged that, you know, there are 100 dice. To kind of make it more worth it from a, like, backer and, like, somebody purchasing the game standpoint, I decided to add in a dice tower. Because, one, people love dice towers. But if you think, like with Wingspan, you get this dice tower and all these things, like, it makes the cost of the game worth more to people without adding in actually, like, that much additional cost. So, like, it offset the cost of the dice with, like, the value add for that.
So going through your versions, it sounds like you had kind of a development arc where at the beginning, everything was changes to make the game easier for people to understand. So a lot of stripping away complications or things that were confusing. And then after you peaked in cutting it down, you started adding in more things to make it interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then that last step, just chopping one thing off because it was too hard.
Indeed.
So Kevin, as the designer, how, and Carla said she likes to work with the designer and go through this, so I'm sure you were very involved in this whole process. So what's it like designing once you're already signed, as opposed to before you can do whatever you want, sky's the limit, and hopefully someone likes it. But once it's signed, you have someone else that you're trying to do things for and align with their vision, but also you have your own vision for it. So what's it like walking that tightrope? Or is it just really easy?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little slower. So usually my designing is just me and I can make quick changes. But working with someone else, I guess after any playtest, we have to exchange feedback and then go through what should be changed or what I want to change and, you know, hear their ideas as well. So. But it's a good process because you get two different groups kind of working on the same game, all with the goal of just trying to make it better.
And you're both far apart too, right? You're not even in the same time zone. So does that make it more complicated to deal with communicating about the game? So is it more like send an email, wait 2 days for a reply, or was it pretty fast on Slack or Discord or just messages?
Seemed pretty quick. Yeah, we used Slack, and yeah, especially earlier on last year, there was a bit more playtesting and back and forth. So
I'm curious about how do you know when the game is done? Because I think so many designers, we keep working on it, and it's never quite where we want it to be.
So for me, it's the whole product aspect of it, and like, does it fit the product line, like, does it fit, like, the target audience? So, like, when you get your target audience and they're playing the game, like, do they love the game? Do they understand the game? Like, I try to make games that are super accessible and, like, you'll just be able to know how to play and the cognitive load isn't that high. So, really, like, when you put it in front of somebody and they can just figure it out. Like, that's a really great moment. And also when I start getting distracted, like, in playtesting, like, I don't always playtest when the playtesting is happening because I get, like, too into the game. Like, if I repeatedly get too into the game and I'm too, like, focused on what I'm doing to, like, pay attention to everyone else, that's also a really good sign that it's, like, really close to being done.
So, anything else you want to talk about?
We're doing a cool different thing with this campaign. So Kickstarter now has pre-launch pages where you can go.
Right.
And
I just read about that. Or yeah. No, someone's talking about it on a podcast that you were doing it. Or both. Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, yes. Describe that.
It's a thing. It's out there. So instead of having people look at like the preview format of the page and then being able to follow the campaign, you just have a main image and you can follow the campaign. And so that's a new thing that I think has been released in the last 6 months. I know it definitely didn't exist last May or July. So yeah, it had to be in the last 6 months. So there's also like a page of all these different campaigns that are going to be launching in the nearish future. But the different thing that I did with it is we made a goal. Like if we could get to 500 followers, then I would give out a free expansion to anyone that was that backed the game. Which I'm really excited about because we're almost to 500 and then we're still like a week and a half out. But the important thing about followers is that anyone that's following the campaign will get an email from Kickstarter when you launch, and also an email during the 48-hour period. And getting that first like day to be really great is super important. And the whole fact that it's from Kickstarter, because sometimes like it's easy to be put into like people's spam or to go like have the email go where you don't want it to go. But from Kickstarter, if people care about Kickstarter things, then they will definitely get the email and they trust it a lot more than, like, it's really easy to click the follow button. It's a lot harder to like sign up for a mailing list and read the like regular newsletter. So I'm excited to see how well that will actually affect that campaign.
Yeah, since they're already in the Kickstarter ecosystem, it really streamlines the process. So, be really interesting to see how this works, especially with that added bonus, because the stretch goals seem to be dying off. Like, it was such a big thing for so many years, and some people just do it because they expect to, but a lot of campaigns are changing it because it kind of warps the whole process and makes it very convoluted and a lot of work on the publisher side. So, they're kind of going away from stuff. So, this is an interesting way, because instead of, like, stretch goals are trying to keep momentum going through that middle lull, this is trying to really push for a really big day one, which, as far as the algorithm goes, is a very important thing to do.
Yeah, and if you have a great day one, then maybe you never have the middle lull.
Exactly. Since we started talking about the Kickstarter, and what are your plans for the Kickstarter? How long is it going to run? I know, like, a month is kind of the typical length, but then I know, like, Buttonshy only does 10-day campaigns because they don't want to deal with that lull, so they just get it out and get it done. But the downside of that is you don't have a lot of time for people to organically find it, so it's either you found it or you didn't, although all their stuff is available online, like, months later anyway, so they don't really have the same ordering issue that bigger games have. So how long are you set up for?
So right now I'm still deciding, mainly because I don't like to start or end campaigns while I'm at a convention or be traveling when I'm at a convention. So I have to figure out where I'm going to be, like what state and everything. I usually do either 21-day campaigns or like 28. So it'll be one of those two. Like, I really like the 21 days because it is, you know, less stressful. Like, that middle lull is so much work. But as you said, like, if you have a longer campaign, you get more people that just find it, and you also give more time for reviewers to finish reviews. Like, most of the first run of reviews for Tumbletown are done, and I'm in the process of organizing like all the games to be sent to another reviewer. But with only like a week and a half before launch, like, those reviewers, like, there's probably little to no chance that they'll actually finish the review by launch. But if the campaign is 30 days, there's a much higher chance that they'll put out something during that time.
That's a good point. Reviewers are very necessary and very tricky to organize. Kevin, so what is your experience with Kickstarter? You're saying this is your first design game, but are you a Kickstarter backer usually, or is this all new to you?
No, I've definitely backed a handful of Kickstarters, but I also have been a part of one. So yeah, even though this was my first design game, I had another game get on a little quicker pipeline timeline that was on Kickstarter last October.
And that was Calico by Flat Out Games.
Which I backed and I'm looking forward to. Because cats, I mean, what are you going to do? Yeah, I just found out the other day that apparently I back a lot of Kickstarters because Gabe from Board Game Design Lab had a survey about Kickstarter backers. And the first one was, how many Kickstarters have you backed? And the very highest level was 101 or more. And I was like, ah, crap, that's me.
Yeah, but you become a super backer when you back like 500, and I've been that for a while.
Yeah, I got a super backer a while ago, and that's the first time I realized, oh no, something might be wrong. Actually, the real problem was when I counted up how much money I'd spent on Kickstarter, realized I was like $40 short of $1,000, so I backed two games.
Oh no.
So yeah, Kickstarter's fun. I've cut back. Now I back for a dollar for people I want to support, because I don't have room for games anymore either.
But backing for a dollar is so important because, like, well, Kickstarter has a variety of algorithms, but one of them is backer count. So you definitely help out with that $1.
And I try to do it on day one if I remember. So listen, everyone, back for a dollar. Back everything for a dollar on day one, and then you can take the dollar back.
I mean, you could, but you could also just leave the dollar in, and that will be, like, help if, like, something weird happens with China. Like, they come down with coronavirus.
So, speaking of coronavirus, I just got an update from a different campaign I backed, which I didn't read the update yet, but the title was Delays in Coronavirus. So this is starting to become a big issue. I mean, obviously coronavirus is a big issue, but it's starting to affect a lot of shipping times for things that are produced in China. So is this something you are looking into or factoring into your timeline?
Oh, so, like, it's already affecting me. It's been affecting me for, like, a month or so. So coronavirus, it started, I don't know, I feel like late December was like one of the first cases, but there was this giant rush for people to ship out before the Chinese New Year, because like there'd be all these like delays and stuff. Like if you're delayed for Chinese New Year with coronavirus, like you're going to be delayed a month or 2 months or 3 months or who knows how long, because we still don't know how bad it is there. So I have a Big Easy Busking where it did get out, like it got out the day of Chinese New Year, which I was like, whoa, I'm so happy about this. But the sleeves did not. So like the deluxe version of the game has custom sleeves, and the sleeves were made improperly. So in a normal situation, it'd be fine. Like, boats are on the water for a long time. We can just remake the sleeves, get them airshipped, and everything. Like, nobody will actually notice. But because of coronavirus, none of the manufacturing plants, like, the people aren't coming back. And currently, they're not allowed to come back until, I don't, like, the last week of February or the first week of March. But that can always change in like a week when the government is like, actually, we can't do that. And then so everyone's backed up and people are going to be sick. Like, that's just a thing that will happen. But like, we still don't know like when those sleeves will possibly get done, and then they have to be shipped. And I've just come to terms with the fact that I have to ship them after the other, like because I want the games to actually get out to the backers without waiting like an indeterminable amount of time. But because like all these delays are happening, like at least a month or 2 months, like all these manufacturers will be backed up. So who knows like how much like manufacturing will cost, like if it'll just be backed up and it'll be fine, or if you'll have to just pay more to get your game manufactured on the timeline that you want it.
Yeah, it's definitely tough running a small business when you have such a huge variable.
Well, and like such a variety of variables, because like, well, like we had the whole tariff situation that was happening last year that turns out never actually happened. But yeah, like we don't know when the coronavirus will be eliminated. Like, I hope it is eliminated. Like, that would be really bad if it goes on for like another 6 months. Like, it could completely change up how board games like cost and are made if like there's a whole 6 month period where nobody can make them.
So actually, I'm just remembering, you were on the Kickstarter episode we did, and you're also on the Starting a Business episode, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
Any updates on either of those now that you've done more Kickstarters and you had just started Galactic Raptor, I think, during the business one, right?
Yes. So I don't like making businesses, and dealing with businesses is hard. So one thing about making a business in Alabama, making a business in each state is very different and stupid. Like, I am completely against states' rights at this point, after like having a business and having to pay taxes in different states for different reasons and having to know how to pay taxes in like 10 states is just stupid. Like, I have been trying to pay the Galactic Raptor taxes for 2 months and I cannot do it. And it's so frustrating because you need like all these different tax numbers, and Nick has just like given up. He's like, I'm not dealing with the business aspect anymore because it's too much for no reason. So like from here on out, like we're just gonna like collaborate with people and have like contracts and stuff, but not actually make another business, because it's really dumb. Like the amount of hoops and like the number of forms just to pay sales tax, which is why like a lot of companies actually don't pay sales tax, but like I try my hardest, I guess.
You're not really making me want to start a business here.
Oh, it's hard.
Like, it's worse than Massachusetts. Although it might be easier to pay the taxes. It's just way more expensive.
Like, it's weird because, like, I want to just pay my taxes. Like, I want to give away my money. And it's so hard. Like, you have to have your FAIN or whatever. Like, you have to have this number. And then you have to apply for all these different sorts of taxes. And sometimes they have to go through mail. And, like, one of the forms, like, they wanted us to have a physical copy of all the signatures. And it's like, well, two of us live in Alabama and one of us lives in New York. So do we really have to, like, ship a copy of the contract that we've signed to Dan and then ship it back? Or, like, can we just sign it online? And it turns out, like, I have to, like, talk with people and go places just to be like, hey, just deal with this. It's fine. We signed it online. The internet, it works. We just want to give you money. And if you want to take my money, then maybe you'll take this contract that, you know, was signed online. Like, the internet's not that bad. But yeah.
Government moves a little slower when it comes to technology.
Well, and that's like the crazy part of it is like, I was thinking about this while trying to do my taxes. Like, I did Pennsylvania taxes, but each state has their own, like, website for doing taxes, and they've developed their own thing where, like, if all the states just did it the same way, it would be so much easier on everyone and easier on the states as well, because they wouldn't have to maintain, like, their weird clunky website that somebody decided needed to have, like, an address auto finder or whatever. But I'm also a software person, so, like, I notice, like, these stupid things, like, oh my gosh, our government spends so much money to create these things when they could just make it easy. Like, I have to pay Pennsylvania taxes every 6 months because I go to PAXU once a year, and, like, so I know that Pennsylvania does their taxes every 6 months, but Alabama does it every month, and I think Ohio is like quarterly. And the only reason why I know all these things is I have a document on my computer that's titled like how to pay taxes for people that don't remember anything, and so it lists out like all the things I have to click on, because each one is very different and it's also not intuitive. So I guess the summary is, make one company, do it once, and from there on out just collaborate and don't make an additional company.
And never sell anything in a different state.
I mean, That would be great, but it's kind of hard, like, because cons are really how you meet people. Like, I've been going to a lot of conventions, and it's been really great for the company, like, to be able to go and meet people in different states. It's just, like, a hassle afterwards, and you have, like, 30 days to try to figure out, like, how the taxes work, and you can't do it, like, right then. Like, I'm one of those people that gets, like, anxiety when I know that something's not done, but all these places, like, they, like, you have to wait for the deadline. So, like, for Pennsylvania taxes, I couldn't, like, leave PAXU. Like, PAXU happened, luckily, like, I think, like, December 1st or whatever, so I had to wait until January 1st to be able to pay those taxes, because maybe I'm going to sell something else in Pennsylvania, even though I'm not going to sell anything in Pennsylvania. But you have to wait for the deadline, and then you have all of January where you have to, like, figure it out and be able to pay it. So it's such a weird system. Other countries, they tell you how much you owe them, and it's so great.
So you just moved to Indiana, and you only sell at Gen Con? Problem solved.
Oh, Gen Con's the worst, though.
So you move to Ohio, you only sell at Origins, problem solved.
Maybe.
PAXU is probably... Is PAXU a better sales con for you?
It depends. So PAXU is a very interesting con. Like, each con is very different in what sells well and what doesn't sell well. So I've also recently gotten into retail, which has been really great. So one of the games that sells really well in retail is Dreams of Tomorrow. And so I know that it sells really well in retail, and it's, like, the first con I actually have it. So I thought it would do really well at PAXU, and I think we sold, like, one copy. So, like, the PAXU audience, well, I've known this, that they're, like, more new to games. Like, the people that go to the other PAXes, they might also go to PAX Unplugged. But I don't think they're, like, into really artistic things. They like, that audience likes, like, the cheaper games, like, $25 and under. While, like, Origins, like, that's more, like, hardcore gamers where, like, they really like, the meatier games. Like, my 4X game does really well at Origins. So, you just have to, like, know about the audience for conventions and, like, bring the right thing, but also be willing to, like, change it up. Like, at PAXU, we started with one table that was doing Animal Kingdoms, which is this really, the art is really good, and it's really accessible to, like, you know, whoever. Everyone can play it. I ended up teaching, like, a four-year-old at PAXU how to play. And that was one of the really cool parts, is, like, actually getting, like, the four-year-old to like, try to battle his father. But anyway, so yeah, at the beginning of the con, there was one table for Animal Kingdoms, and by the end of the con, we had migrated to three tables all demoing Animal Kingdoms, because that was just a game that was doing a lot better for the PAXU crowd.
So where would you say Tumbletown fits in your line as far as, like, weight, and which con do you think it'll sell best at?
So I think it'll do really well at Origins because it is, well, like, it's not as easy as Fire in the Library or Animal Kingdoms. It has, like, a weight to it, and it also has a price point. I believe we're going to sell it on the Kickstarter for $39, and I don't think, like, I think that's too high for PAXU, but I think, like, the Origins crowd, like, they know that board games cost money, so they'll do a lot, I hope that it'll do really well at Origins, and also the whole dice stacking thing, because Origins is also a really good demo con, in that, like, a lot of people play a lot of demos. Gen Con is, like, a super selly con where you don't do as many demos, but Origins, people just want to be taught how to play games, and they just go, like, booth to booth, like, playing games and being taught games, and then they'll go, like, on Sunday and buy all the games that they liked from the ones that they were taught. So, yeah, like, if you get somebody to play Tumbletown, like, play a few turns of it or a full game, I think, well, everyone's loved it once they start playing, so Origins. Origins is also weird in that it has an event system that people super go into the events. So if you're going to Origins, just make a lot of events and then people will discover your games. Versus like Gen Con, where people are like all consuming, buying, and they you have to like provide your own audience for the Gen Con events, because like some people will sign up for something they don't know, but there's just so many things out there that like you'll get lost in the waves of all the things at Gen Con. And PAX U doesn't have events. They have like they have all these gates to all these things. Like you can submit your game to be like in the family section or to be taught to people. But I haven't been accepted into any of those yet. So I can't say like how that sort of event system works. But maybe in the future I'll experience it.
Hopefully. I mean, you're starting to grow your catalog. Like you said, you're in retail now, which I know that takes usually a few titles before you can get in.
And retail is so weird. Like I'm experiencing this thing now where, so Dreams of Tomorrow has sold really well. But I get told about like selling of the game, like 30 to 60 days after it's sold. And I also don't get to see my inventory. So I can just guess how many games that, well, I'm with Impressions, and Impressions is a consolidator. So I can guess how many games that Impressions has. But I don't know for sure unless I ask, and it's a super manual process to see the number. So I recently like asked, like, how many games do you have? Do you have any? And I was told a number, and like I calculated like how many I sent them and how many have sold. And it's like, oh, so I'll get a paycheck for at least 75 sold in the next month or two, probably. Just because like so Impressions sells to distributors. And they might be on like a 30-day or 60-day pay period, and I'm not getting paid until Impressions gets paid. But going further with this is like I'm currently thinking like when a reprint should happen, and that should probably happen after like the retail stores sell out. But to have the retail stores sell out, I have to know that Impressions has sold out, and then all the distributors have sold out, and then some months later, theoretically, all the actual retail stores sell out, which is all, like, big kind of a headache, actually, because, like, every game store is probably owned by one person, and most people, like, board game store owners, like, they might own, like, one or two stores, but, like, any more of that is super rare, so I'd have to, like, ask people, like, hey, do you have Fire in the Library in your store or Dreams of Tomorrow? Like, or just like ask like people to go look around the country. Like, is this game in stores? Cause there's no way of me knowing if it is or not.
Yeah. A lot of what I've been hearing on podcasts from the business side is like the new topic is, are there too many games coming out? And a lot of companies have decided to cut back on the number of titles they do per year, like the bigger companies. But a lot of what I'm hearing is that the distributors aren't restocking because they have so many games that they have to get rid of anyway, so that when a store is out and they say, oh, can I get Fire in the Library? The distributor's like, oh, I don't have any. And they're like, oh, I'll just get whatever else, because a game's a game to fill their shelf at a certain point. So a lot of companies are having trouble knowing when they're out of stock and keeping things moving.
Well, and because there's just so many people in the process, like the distributor has to know when they'll sell out, so they have to order more, and like there's time between it. Like I had a real hard trouble, like actually, like Fire in the Library went into retail in July, and retailers like repeatedly couldn't get it until like even in October. Like in November, I think it started being like a lot easier, to get Fire in the Library for the retailers, just because all of the, distributors would only order like six or some low number, and then they'd sell out. So they'd have to order more. Like, I think they had to like sell out a number of times before they were willing to go and buy like 20 at a time.
That's the other thing. Everyone at every step doesn't want to commit too much and then get burned on it if it doesn't work. So there's a lot of fear and a slow process of ordering and shipping and manufacturing. So it's slow.
Mm-hmm.
So Kevin, you've been silent for a while as we talk about all this business stuff. So how are you feeling with the start of, well, almost the start of the Kickstarter and hopefully the successful funding and release of your game?
I'm feeling pretty good about it. I mean, it's nice to see that that Kickstarter follower page number go up, and I've seen at least one review come in, and from a fairly prominent reviewer, and it was, they liked it, so yeah, feeling pretty good about it.
They said it was flawless.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good review. So we're closing in on an hour of recording, which is hopefully a little less when I cut this all down. So why don't we wrap this up? Why don't we end with just the full-on solid get people to buy your game pitch for Tumbletown.
Okay, so Tumbletown, it is a spatial puzzle town and engine building game for 1 to 4 players that plays in about 45 minutes. This game, it's you're trying to be a mayor in the Old West. And if you can score enough points, you can win the game and become mayor. It has set collection as well, hidden objectives, and it will most likely come with a free expansion, as we're only like 30 followers away from getting that and a week and a half out. If you want to visit the Kickstarter page, you can do so by going to weirddraftgames.com/TTKS. And it'll bring you to the Kickstarter page or the pre-launch page, depending on when you go to it. But yeah, I think it's really cool. It has a bunch of different mechanics, like the fact you can the scoring system where you can get more scoring objectives as the game goes on, and those scoring objectives care about the artwork and things that are in the cards right now. So yeah, Tumbletown. If you like spatial or engine building or dice manipulation, or if you just like cool dice towers, because my partner Nick designed a really unique dice tower that he was super proud of that has like a drop shaft in it. So if you're like a dice tower nerd, then you might also be into this game.
Sounds great. You said the price point was probably going to be $39 for the Kickstarter?
Yep.
Are you doing a deluxe version or just the single version?
We're doing just the regular version, but we're doing a version where you can get a play mat as well, because people love play mats. And, I mean, the artwork is pretty nice. I like it a lot, and I hope that other people like the art enough to get the full play mat. It'll also make setup slightly easier.
Well, good luck with the Kickstarter. Is there anything else you have coming up as far as projects or events either of you will be at that you want to pitch before we close this up?
As far as conventions, I'll be at Gamma, Origins, Gen Con, Proto ATL. And if anyone is there and wants to talk, like, well, I love board games, so let's talk about board games or whatever else you are interested in. I also have Kingdoms of the Deep coming from Galactic Raptor Games, which is an area control simultaneous action selection game that is a sequel to Animal Kingdoms. It plays 1 to 6 players in about 45 to 60 minutes. And later this year, we're going to come out with the Fire in the Library card game, which I'm excited about because, like,
oh, really?
I don't know, Burning Library card game. And it should be a lower price point than Fire in the Library. So, like, if you love saving books, you could save books in a different way.
It's a solid pitch. Kevin, you got anything coming up?
Just a few conventions. I'll be at Dice Tower West and also Gamma, Origins, and Gen Con. I always have prototypes with me, so always looking to play them.
And they're always great and usually spatial.
Cool. Will either of you be at Unpub Prime?
Yes. Yeah, that is a thing that I'll be at. I'm going to like 20 conventions this year, so.
Sounds like a fun and exhausting time.
Exhausting, indeed. But I get to see people. Like Kevin, repeatedly, every month.
Also sounds fun and exhausting. All right, let's close this up with contact info one last time, and then I think we have an episode.
Yay. So I'm Carla Kopp. I'm at Weird Drafts on Twitter. My website is weirddraftgames.com. If you want to see the Kickstarter page, it's weirddraftgames.com/TTKS. And I'm on Instagram and Facebook at Weird Draft Games or Carla Kopp if you want to, like, actually friend me instead of just following the company. And we have a Facebook group that's the Weird Draft Games Insiders, so you could see everything that's coming up with Weird Draft Games as I ask lots of questions, and I actually take the feedback because, I mean, if you're part of the group, you're probably part of my audience, so I should take the feedback. That's the intelligent thing.
And Kevin?
Kevin Russ. On Twitter, it's Kevin T. Russ, and Instagram, Gorge River Game Studio.
Yeah, so speaking of your Twitter, you know, on Twitter analytics, like every month it tells you who your top follower is based on like who followed you that month that has the most followers. And you were my top follower in January because you have over 40,000 followers, which seems a little absurd to what I'm used to on Twitter.
Yeah, a lot of those are from probably when I started. So I had a friend who worked at Twitter and he put me on like a photographer list. I don't know if...
Yeah, that might help.
If they start still early. Do that, but yeah.
Well, anyway. And Kevin is a really great photographer, like super great photographer. Like he does photography for like Apple, but also he does board game photography. And I keep telling him he should do like calendars or postcards or something with board games. So yep. Maybe that'll happen.
Board game photography is getting pretty popular. I know a couple of different people that do it and do calendars, and it works out. The world needs more calendars.
I mean, every year it needs a new calendar.
Just do a monthly one. That way you can turn them over quicker. All right. That's an episode. Thank you both for coming on. Good luck with the Kickstarter. I don't think I'm forgetting anything.
Well, thanks, Chris.
Carl, you've done this before.
I don't know. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And, you know, go to the website and listen to other episodes if you like this one.
So, I actually just today looked at the space for the next Board Game Workshop Design Day, which will be October 17th at the VFW in Franklin, Massachusetts. It's going to be a 10-hour design day. You rent a table, so like similar to Unpub. We did one last year. Went very well, so look for more details on that. And the Board Game Workshop Design Contest is open for submissions, though they're not due till June 5th. So I don't expect any too soon, but we're also taking judge signups now if anybody wants to head over to the website and sign up to be a judge. And if you are a judge, you can still enter. I'm trying to keep this very open this year and see how it works. So I think that's all the updates, and hopefully this episode posts because I'm doing a new host for the podcast. Yeah, awesome. Thank you again, and good night. That's all for this episode. The Board Game Workshop is a member of the Indie Game Report. You can check out their reviews and interviews at theindiegamereport.com. Thank you to all of our Patreon supporters, especially our Inventor Level supporters, Chris Turner, Vegan Al, Brad Batchelor, Roscoe Schock, Vas Kottis, and Corey Mudiman. If you'd like to support the show, go to patreon.com/theboardgameworkshop. You can follow the show on Twitter at @TheBGWorkshop and on Facebook at @TheBoardGameWorkshop. Join the show's Discord channel to discuss episodes. You can call the show's Google Voice number at 725-222-8249 and leave a question or contributor segment for a future episode. You can get the links for these and all show notes at theboardgameworkshop.com. Thanks for listening.